Georgia. The cop had admitted to perjury, so I knew the opinion would come fairly soon, and I knew it would be favorable. I'd also been thinking about my own situation. Finding James Tipton was the only hope I had of getting out of prison, and nobody on the outside was having any luck. Grace was trying. She wrote to me often, so I knew she'd been talking to agents from the FBI and DEA, and that she'd tried to locate Tipton on her own, but her resources and her time were limited. If Tipton was going to be found, someone would have to make it their mission, and I knew I was the only person who would do it. I placed my hands on the table, leaned forward and lowered my voice. "Can you get me out?" I said. He blinked slowly a few times before he responded.
"You mean get you out of here, I assume. You're talking about helping you escape."
"I don't belong in here," I said. "I'm not going to make it much longer."
"You'll make it as long as you want to," he said, "because you're smart and you're tough. But you're right when you say you don't belong in here. You don't."
"Do you think it could be done?" I said.
"Yeah, it could be done. As a matter of fact, I've had something in mind for a few years now. Never tried it, but I think it could work. It'd cost some money. 10, maybe 20 grand.
"I have money," I said, which is ironic, because I didn't have any when I was a lawyer on the outside. "But I've been saving pretty much every dime I've earned in here."
"What would you do if you got out?" Pappy said. "I mean, if you got out and got away from the prison clean. Where would you go?"
"Back to Tennessee. I need to find a guy who testified against me at my trial. I'm not sure where he is, but I'd start in Tennessee."
"So you'll need to get outside the walls and then get a ride back to Tennessee. You'll need clothes and traveling money, a vehicle, a prepaid cell phone or two, and some sort of fake identification in case you get stopped by a cop. You know that's the first place they're gonna look for you. You're from Knoxville, right?"
"Yeah."
"Knoxville will be crawling with feds looking for you. They'll be all over your mom and your boy. You won't be able to go near them. And they'll pop you with an escape charge if they catch you."
"And do what? Give me life plus 10 years?
"They'll probably diesel you for a year, and then throw you in the hole for another year."
"If you help me get out, I'm not coming back," I said. "I'll shoot myself before I'll come back here."
I'd spent so much time alone that I felt I knew myself better than ever before, and I knew that if I got out, I would never willingly come back.
After being a part of and seeing so much brutality and cruelty and injustice, I knew that if I got away and was about to be caught, I would put a bullet in my brain before I allowed them to subject me to the kind of mental and physical abuse I'd endured for the past 2 years. I wouldn't let them do it to me for the rest of my life.
"Speaking of, will you need a gun?"
"Yeah, if you can do it."
"I can do anything, Darren. I'm the shot caller on this yard, and I've made enough money to buy an island."
"Why haven't you escaped then?"
"I'm not really sure, except I've always had a feeling that Ronnie Ray would eventually be exposed for the lying piece of shit he really is, and I'd get out. I believed in the system."
"That's a load of crap, Pappy."
"You're right. Sue me."
"So how would it work?"
"Pretty simple, really, if my guy is willing to do it."
"Your guy? Who's that?"
"A cowboy I know. Crazy as hell, not afraid of anything. We did 3 years together at Lewisburg when I first came in. He can get you past the gates if everything goes well. Then I'll hook you up with a cowgirl I know. She's crazier than the cowboy. I guess she's my woman now. She also works for me on the outside."
"Works for you? Doing what?"
"I run a legit trucking company on the outside. Get 2 18-wheelers. She drives one of them. We'll get you from him to her and put you in the sleeper of her truck. She can drive you across the country."
"How is your cowboy going to get me past the gates?"
"It'll be a hoot, Darren. You'll love it. Timing will be everything."
"How long will it take you to set it up?"
"Not long. If I know the cowboy like I think I do, he'll drop everything and come as soon as we want him to. I'll get in touch with the woman, too, and have her head this way. Maybe a week. When do you want to go?"
"The sooner the better." What happens if you get transferred back to Georgia in the meantime?
I could make it happen from the outside, but I'd rather be here when it goes down. I want to watch.
You'd really do all this for me?
Yeah, man. You realize you're already a legend in this place, don't you?
You're crazy. 99% of the guys in here don't even know I'm alive.
You're wrong. Guys talk about you all the time. Think about it. You're a lawyer who went down on a charge of killing a child-molesting murderer. You put in a bunch of work on the guards and got dieseled for months. That's legendary stuff right there. But then you come in here and start taking up cases for people, doing good work. And you kick that redneck's ass in front of God and everybody on the yard. Then you take him on again in your cell, get popped 11 times with 12 inches of steel, live through it, and won't talk to the police about it. That's powerful, man. And it gets around. Plus, you don't have any vices, which shows everybody you're mentally strong. You have as much respect as any man on this yard, including me.
And here I sit talking about leaving all of it. How selfish of me.
And now you're going to escape? I'm getting chills thinking about it. You'll be like a god. If you ever get caught, which you probably will, and you don't shoot yourself, which you probably won't, you'll go straight to the top of the class when you come back inside. You'll be a shot caller as soon as you walk on a yard.
That's great, Pappy, I said. It gives me great comfort knowing I have so much to look forward to if I don't manage to kill myself and get sent back here.
You won't get sent back here, Darren, now that I think about it. Prison administrators hate guys like you. Guys that gain so much respect, they'll think you have too much power, so they'll neutralize you. They'll send you to Marion or Florence for at least 3 years, probably 5. If you escape and then get caught, you're going straight to Supermax.
Chapter 51. Just the thought of getting out of Rosewood and getting back to the world made me feel weightless over the next week. I was terrified, too, because I had no idea what would happen during the escape attempt, and because I wasn't sure what I'd do even if I made it out and got back to Tennessee. I knew where I was going to start, but I didn't know where it would lead. Still, the worst thing that could happen as far as I was concerned was being captured and returned to prison. The thought of getting killed, which was entirely possible, didn't really bother me. Big Pappy set everything up. We had several conversations, usually in his cell. We kept them short so we wouldn't arouse undue suspicion, but by that time Pappy and I had become close enough friends that it wasn't unusual for us to be seen talking to each other. During one of the conversations, I learned how Pappy communicated so easily with the outside world. He bought prepaid cell phones that one of the guards smuggled in. They cost him $1,000 apiece, but he was able to use them to run the various businesses he'd set up during his prison tenure. He told me he'd made $4 million during his 11 years in prison off tobacco and gambling, and he'd been able to turn it into $10 million. The woman who would be driving me back to Tennessee, whom Pappy described as a hellcat named Linda Lacey, was responsible for running the day-to-day operations of Pappy's trucking company. She had been his girlfriend when he was arrested, and had stayed loyal to him throughout his incarceration. He wouldn't tell me much about the cowboy other than he was the craziest son of a bitch I've ever met. 2 days before I was supposed to go, I said, "You haven't even told me how I'm getting past the walls."
"You're going to fly," Pappy said. "All you have to do is be where I tell you to be when I tell you to be there. The cowboy was a drug mule back in the day. The army taught him to fly helicopters, and as soon as he got out, he started moving cocaine for some dudes in Philadelphia. He wound up getting popped and serving 3 years. That's how we met. He got his pilot's license back a year after he got out and wound up starting a charter service in Phoenix."
"And he's willing to risk everything to help me get out of here?"
"He isn't doing it for free," Pappy said. "But I think he might have if I'd asked him. This is just something that appeals to his flair for the outrageous and dramatic. Besides, he says he's bored. We're going to set the exact time tomorrow. It looks like the weather is going to be good. He's going to come screaming in here, scoop you up and get out. There won't be any ID numbers on the helo, and it'll be painted a different color within 24 hours of the escape. If everything goes right, it shouldn't take more than 10-15 seconds to get in and out. The guards might get off a shot or two, but they might not. Nobody's ever tried to escape from this place by helicopter, so it'll take them by surprise. Maybe they'll think the director of the Bureau of Prisons has come to visit. Once you're out, he's going to fly you to meet Linda on Highway 41, about 45 miles from here. He'll drop you off and then fly straight to a cabin in the Sierra Nevadas. Then, he's flying straight back to Phoenix the next morning. It's risky, but if anybody can pull it off, it's Cowboy. 48 hours later, I was on the yard at 6:45 p.m. It was mid-April, almost 2 years to the day since I'd been arrested for Jalen Jordan's murder. The sky had been clear all day. I said thank you one last time to Big Pappy Donovan and told him I'd see him again someday, on the outside. I hoped I was right. I jogged around the perimeter fence for a while like I always did, but at 6:49 p.m. I walked to the middle of the soccer field and looked to the west. 30 seconds later, I thought I heard the whop-whop-whop-whop of helicopter blades. I looked to the west again, but was blinded by the setting sun. Suddenly, I saw it, and within seconds, I was engulfed in a cloud of dust and deafening noise as the helicopter came out of the sun, cleared the outer wall, and appeared to stand on its legs like a rearing horse. It touched down 30 feet from where I was standing, and I made a break for it. The door opened, and I dived inside onto one of the two seats in the cockpit. The pilot was wearing a ski mask. He reached over me and pulled the door shut, pulled the stick, and we were off the ground and over the concertina wire-topped wall. I looked at the guard tower in the center of the prison yard and could see two guards scrambling onto the catwalk with weapons. We were gone before they could get off a shot. The man in the seat next to me pulled the ski mask off his head. He looked to be in his early 30s and had light brown hair cut like a Marine's. He was grinning widely and turned and winked at me. He motioned toward a pair of headphones that were hanging over the seat behind me. I picked them up and put them on.
"Hot damn," he said. "What a rush. I'm Cowboy. You must be Darren."
"Yeah, I'm Darren. I appreciate the ride."
"You did great," he said. "You were on board less than 5 seconds after I hit the deck. I was afraid we might end up with a straggler or two, but you got on so fast nobody could react quick enough to cause us a problem."
"So what now?" I said.
"I'm going to head north for another 2 minutes so they think that's the direction we're heading in. Then I'm going to head east and double back to the south. We're going into the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Pappy's woman is driving an 18-wheeler on Highway 41. I know exactly where she's supposed to be. It's a curvy mountain road and there isn't much traffic. As soon as it's clear, we're going to do the same thing we did back at the prison, only this time you're getting out of the helicopter instead of into it. You jump off of the chopper and into the truck. I'll fly away and she'll take it from there."
"Every cop in this part of the country is going to be looking for you," I said.
"Yeah, ain't he cool as hell? Don't worry about it. It's desert and mountains around here. Very few people, very few cops. Besides, I got a pretty good plan. I'll make it back home tomorrow and nobody'll know a thing."
He was right about the terrain. It was barren and rugged. The sun was still up, barely, and we were close to the ground. "How fast are we going?" I said.
"Little over 100 knots, about 120 miles an hour.
We flew for another 30 seconds before he turned the helicopter to the east and then to the south. We flew for about 10 minutes before he turned east again and started into the mountains. About 3 minutes later, he pointed down and I spotted a truck snaking through a switchback.
"It's gonna be hurt," Cowboy said.
He flipped a switch on a radio and said some things I couldn't hear. The next thing I knew, the earth was coming up quickly. I saw the truck slow to a stop, and Cowboy landed the helicopter in the middle of the road about 50 yards away.
"Good luck, brother man,"
Cowboy yelled. He reached across me, opened the door, and gave me a shove. I hit the ground running and climbed into the cab of the truck. Part 3. Chapter 52. I climbed into the cab of Linda Lacey's 18-wheeler and watched Cowboy climb away in his helicopter just as darkness was beginning to fall.
"Hey, baby, you made it,"
she said as I looked at her stupidly. She was a striking woman with long, sandy blonde hair that fell out from beneath a straw cowboy hat. Her face was pretty, dominated by cool blue eyes and a sharp nose,
and she seemed to dwarf me in the cab. Unfolded, I'd have bet she was well over 6 feet tall. I supposed it was one of the attractions to Big Pappy, who was one of the largest human beings I'd ever met in my life.
"What's the matter? Did they numb your brain in prison?"
she said as the truck rolled forward. There hadn't been a single vehicle in sight when Cowboy set the helicopter down on the road. I had to give them credit. They'd planned my escape thoroughly, although we still had a long way to go. "Sorry," I said. "I guess I'm still in shock a little. I was in a maximum security federal penitentiary 15 minutes ago."
"And now you're out," Linda said. "On the road to sweet freedom. And before we go any further, I just want to say thank you for what you've done for Michael. He was beginning to lose hope."
"Michael?" I said.
"My Michael. His big shot name in prison is Big Pappy, but to me he's just plain old Michael. Listen, you need to crawl up into this sleeper here behind me and change clothes. I think they'll fit."
She pulled the curtain back and I climbed through an opening and onto a bed. Sitting on the bed was a small pile of neatly folded clothes, black jeans, a white t-shirt, and a light blue denim work shirt, a belt, a pair of underwear, a pair of white socks, and a pair of Nike running shoes.
"There's a false wall back there," Linda said when I was finished. "If you'll just reach down behind the mattress toward where the pillow is. No, sweetie, on the other wall. Yeah, there, feel it? Pull that latch. Now just push the back wall up. See? If we get stopped, you crawl back in there and stay quiet. For now, just put your jail clothes in there. We'll burn them first chance we get."
"How long before we get back to Tennessee?" I said.
"What? You've been in my truck for 5 minutes, and you already want to know how long before you get out? That's a bit ungrateful, don't you think?"
"I'm sorry. Linda? Your name is Linda, right? I'm grateful for everything you've done and for everything you're going to do. I'll ride around with you for as long as you like. I was just curious." She turned around and leered at me.
"Now you're patronizing me," she said. "Why is it that men always think they can patronize women just by being polite?"
"I wasn't trying to... I didn't mean to..."
"You think women aren't as smart as men, don't you?"
"Of course not."
"Name one woman that you think is as smart as men, not including your mother. Be quick about it."
"Marie Curie."
"Who?"
"Marie Curie. She was a physicist and chemist. Lived in the late 18, early 1900s. She was Polish, but wound up moving to France. She was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize. She was as smart as any man who's ever lived."
"Right," Linda said. "What about somebody more recent?"
"Hillary Clinton's pretty smart. First Lady, U.S. Senator, Secretary of State."
"That doesn't mean she's smart."
Linda's voice moved up in pitch.
"She's just conniving."
"So you're a Republican then?"
"Yes, I'm a Republican, and I'm proud to be a Republican. It doesn't make me hateful, and it doesn't make me stupid. What about you? I guess you're one of those Blue Dog Democrats."
"Right now I'm a convicted felon and an escapee. I don't think anybody's going to care about my personal political preferences." She was quiet for a while after that. I lay in the sleeper cab and watched road signs go by. We headed south on Interstate 5. In the meantime, Linda was listening to the radio for news about the escape. The first story came about an hour after I got into the truck. The reporters were saying that I was last seen heading north from Rosewood in a helicopter. So far so good, I thought. But within 10 minutes of hearing that story, I saw flashing lights ahead at the side of the road.
"Better get on back behind the false wall," Linda said.
I pulled the latch, lifted the wall, rolled back, and pushed it down. My heart was beating so hard, I could feel it against my chest. I could feel my hands shaking, my breath coming in short gasps. I'd been out for only an hour. Would Linda screw up? Would they have dogs? Would they catch me and have me back in the hole at Rosewood by morning? The truck slowed agonizingly. Then it stopped.
"Evening, ma'am," I heard a male voice say. "License and registration, please. Where are you headed?"
"Georgia, by way of Nashville," Linda said.
"Long trip. What are you hauling?"
"Hardwood flooring."
"Had anything to drink tonight?"
"No, sir. I don't drink alcohol."
"My wife wishes I could say the same. Have you heard about the escape?"
As a matter of fact, I heard something on the radio about an escape just before I saw your lights.
A man was plucked out of a federal penitentiary by helicopter. He might switch to some other form of transportation, though. It happened just a short time ago, but we've managed to get some flyers out. Would you mind taking a few and spreading them around the next time you pull into a truck stop?
I wouldn't mind at all, sir.
Mind if I take a quick look around inside your cab?
Go right ahead.
I shuddered as I lay in the complete darkness, the utter stillness of the false compartment. My heart kept pounding, the thump, the thump, the thump. An endless 30 seconds passed.
Okay, ma'am, you have a safe night.
I heard the truck's engine roar and felt the rig pull back onto the road and get up to speed.
Hey, Darren,
I heard Linda say.
You can come out now.
I pulled the inside latch, lifted the door, and crawled out. Linda tossed a small stack of papers over her shoulder at me.
The good thing is, you take a nice photograph,
she said.
The bad thing is, they look just like you.
Chapter 53. For 5 days, I'd ridden across the United States in Linda Lacey's sleeper. She drove 9 hours a day, and at night, we shared a motel room. On the first night, she colored my hair blonde, took a picture of me on her cell phone, and texted it to someone.
For your ID,
she said. The next morning, rather than follow I-40 straight across the middle of the country, she drove north into Colorado and drove across Kansas and Missouri. It added some extra miles and a day to the trip, but she thought it was prudent, and who was I to argue? Linda acted like a cross between a mother and a frustrated nymphomaniac. Her man had been in prison for 11 years, and she had apparently been loyal to him with the exception of the various sexual toys she'd used, and which she described to me in painful detail. The poor woman was as horny as any I'd ever seen. She talked nonstop and blared country and western music through the cab's speakers. If I never hear another Merle Haggard song again, it'll be just fine with me. She didn't try to seduce me, though. Not that I would have allowed it. Big Pappy had gotten me out of prison. I wouldn't have repaid him by surreptitiously having sex with his woman. But as much as I hate to, I have to admit I thought about it. She was a lanky, big-breasted Amazon who looked fantastic in a pair of blue jeans, and who I'm certain would have given me the ride of my life. Besides, I was fresh out of prison and was as frustrated as she was. I hadn't touched a woman in 2 years. I found myself imagining what she'd look like naked on more than one occasion. We finally made it to Knoxville on the fifth night. I felt a surge of adrenaline as we passed by the University of Tennessee campus and the World's Fair Tower around 10 at night. Linda had told me we would be meeting up with a friend of hers at the Strawberry Plains exit. When we got there, she pulled off the road into a parking lot adjacent to a liquor store. Sitting in the lot with its lights on was a Hyundai Elantra that was silver and maybe 5 years old.
This is it, baby doll, Linda said. You're on your own from here.
I slid into the seat next to her.
Everything you need will be in the car, she said. A driver's license, registration, insurance papers, everything. If you get stopped and the cops run the tag, it'll come back registered to the name on the license. It's a clean car. You'll find money, 3 prepaid cell phones, more clothes, and a gun in the trunk.
I don't know how to thank you, I said. She reached over, grabbed me by the neck, pulled me toward her, and gave me a long kiss on the lips. At the same time, she reached between my legs and gave me a nice little rub.
Good luck, desperado, she said. Maybe Michael and I'll see you again sometime.
I hope so, I said, and I turned and climbed down out of the cab and took a deep breath. It was spring in the mountains of East Tennessee. There was a chill in the air, but the sky was clear and the place smelled like heaven. I couldn't believe I was back. I walked over to the Elantra, which was running, and opened the door. Just then, I noticed a man walk quickly between the car and the cab of the truck. He opened the door and climbed into the same seat I had just vacated. I didn't get a look at his face. I got into the Elantra and started driving east on Interstate 40. I got off the interstate at the Gatlinburg Pigeon Forge exit and turned south. 45 minutes later, I drove past James Tipton's driveway. I went back and forth a couple of times before I finally pulled in. It was one of the eeriest sights I'd ever seen. The skulls remained, but James's trailer was gone. I pulled up close to the spot and could see a pile of black ashes on the ground and the skeleton of his former home. Grace had told me only that James had disappeared. She hadn't told me his trailer was burned. I turned the car around and pulled back onto the road, heading up the mountain. After another half mile, I turned the car off the road into a chat driveway that was nearly a half mile long and led into a hollow at the base of a steep mountain ridge. At the end of the driveway was a small wooden house, neatly kept and painted white, flanked by two cabins. It was the same house where I'd watched the Tipton family dance in the yard. It was the same house where I'd shared their food and their drink and listened to their music and their stories. It was Granny Tipton's house. I got out of the car, walked around to the back, and opened the trunk. There was a black duffel bag sitting there, and I began to feel around inside of it. I felt the clothing, the phones, a couple of stacks of money, and finally, the cold steel of a pistol. Before I was able to pull the pistol out of the bag, I heard two clicks behind me. They sounded like hammers being pulled back on shotguns.
"What the hell you doing up here, boy?"
a voice said, and I felt a gun barrel being pressed to the back of my neck. I saw a flash of bright light, and then there was nothing. Chapter 54. Grace walked into Boots Little Honky Tonk on Northside Drive in Knoxville, just after 8 at night. The cigarette smoke rolling out of the place nearly choked her. A fat male karaoke singer in a brown cowboy hat was butchering Tim McGraw's Live Like You Were Dying on a makeshift stage, and the music was loud. As she looked around, a bit stunned, she felt someone take her arm from behind. She turned and found herself standing face to face with Gary DuBose, a DEA agent whom she knew casually, who had called her earlier in the day and asked to meet at this most unusual spot.
"I've got a booth in the back,"
DuBose hollered over the din. Grace followed him past a red car hood that was hanging on a wall with a huge breasted image of Dolly Parton painted on it. The place was full and loud and smelled of fried bar food, stale beer, and, of course, cigarettes. As DuBose walked in front of her, Grace took note of his wide shoulders and thick neck. He was wearing blue jeans and a black and red flannel shirt, along with a pair of boots. His head was covered by a black baseball cap with an orange T above the bill. They settled into the booth. Grace's back was to the front door and the majority of the crowd, which made her immediately uncomfortable, but her only alternative would have been to slide across and sit next to DuBose, and that wasn't going to happen. She noticed DuBose had a Budweiser sitting in front of him. His reputation was that he was honest and hardworking, the son of the former sheriff of Knox County. He had testified during two hearings in which Grace had been involved, and he had given what she believed to be truthful and unexaggerated testimony.
"Beer?"
DuBose said as a waitress approached. Grace nodded.
"Sure. Same as yours."
DuBose pointed at his bottle, held up two fingers, and the waitress went away.
"Okay, I'm intrigued," Grace said. "What can I do for you?"
DuBose took a sip from his beer.
"What do you hear from Darren Street?"
It had been 5 days since Darren's unbelievable escape from the federal penitentiary in California. Every U.S. Marshal and FBI agent within 50 miles had called and asked her the same question.
"Are you kidding me?" Grace said. "You asked me down here to try to drag information about my client out of me?"
Grace started to get up to leave, but DuBose placed a hand on her forearm.
"Please don't go," he said. "It was just a joke. I want to talk to you about something important. It might help you, and it might help your client."
Grace sat back down and folded her arms.
"I'm listening, but not for long," she said.
"You have to understand this is hard for me, Miss Alexander," DuBose said. "I'm a law enforcement guy. I'm part of a fraternity. My father was a sheriff. He and Ben Clancy were friends for a long time, although I have to admit toward the end, before my father fell off the roof and was killed, He told me he was starting to worry about some of the things Clancy was doing, and had done in the past. I think his conscience was starting to bother him.
Why are you telling me all this? Grace said.
Because my conscience has been bothering me, too,
DuBose said.
Especially since your client has been back in the news, back in everyone's faces. I've thought about it and prayed about it, and thought about it and prayed about it some more. My father always taught me to try to do the right thing, even when it was difficult. Well, like I said, this is really difficult.
The waitress arrived with two beers. DuBose gave her a $10 bill and told her to keep the change.
Did you call me the night before the trial?
Grace said.
Beg your pardon?
Somebody called me the night before the trial started and told me Darren was innocent. Was it you?
No, it wasn't.
Grace studied his face, trying to read whether he was lying. His expression didn't change a bit, and she decided he was telling the truth.
And you say this has something to do with Darren Street?
DuBose nodded.
James Tipton lied at the trial, Miss Alexander. I don't know everything he lied about, and I don't know exactly why, but he lied. And Ben Clancy knew he was lying and let him do it. He may even have put him up to it.
Grace felt her back stiffen and her pulse quicken. She told herself to stay calm, go slowly, think clearly. This could be nothing, or this could be everything. Think like a lawyer. Don't be emotional. Be analytical.
What specifically did he lie about at trial, and how do you know it?
Grace said.
He lied when you asked him if he'd been offered anything by the government in return for his testimony. I wasn't at the trial, but I read it in the paper. The paper said you made a big deal out of him being offered something, but he kept saying the only reason he was there was because they'd found that gun and traced it back to him, and were trying to pin the murder on him. But they weren't offering him anything.
Do you know exactly what James Tipton had been offered?
I know his drug case disappeared completely. I was working the case myself. We were close to indicting him. If we'd done it, and he'd been convicted, he would have gone away for 30 years.
What else can you tell me?
Grace said, ignoring the beer.
This is how it happened, Miss Alexander, to the best of my knowledge. I'm sure your client has told you he initially tried to hire James Tipton to kill Jalen Jordan, since he testified to it publicly at the trial. I'd been to see Tipton not too long before that to tell him we were about to indict him and to find out whether I could squeeze information about his suppliers in Florida out of him. Initially, he wouldn't help me, so I just kept working the case like normal. But then one night, out of the blue, Tipton calls me and tells me about this encounter with Darren Street. He says Street came to his house and tried to hire him, that a child killer might possibly be involved, and asked whether I'd be willing to make a deal for that kind of information. I tell him I might, and I immediately call Ben Clancy because of Clancy's longtime relationship with my father and because Darren Street had said some pretty nasty things about my father before he died. Thinking back on it, I probably shouldn't have gone to Clancy, but then again, who else would I go to? If I'd gone to my boss, he'd have gone to Clancy. If I'd gone to the FBI, they'd have gone to Clancy. If I'd gone to Clancy's boss, he would have turned it over to Clancy. So anyway, I meet Clancy the next morning and tell him that Street has tried to hire a hitman and has already paid $50,000 in cash. Clancy doesn't set up stings or start assigning agents as you would expect. He tells me he wants to handle the whole thing himself, and because of the bad blood between him and Street, I can sort of understand it. He has me set up a meet with Tipton at a safe house, and from then on, I don't see Tipton again. Clancy does come to my boss later on, about a month after Jalen Jordan was shot, and asks him to bury the drug case on Tipton so he can get a conviction on Darren. He convinces my boss Darren is guilty of murder, and that Tipton is his best witness. And my boss agrees to lose the paperwork and the computer files. Poof. No more drug case.
You realize that this is enough to get Darren a new trial? Maybe even a dismissal?
Grace said.
I do. And I'm sorry I didn't tell you about it sooner. Like I said, I worried about it and prayed about it so much that I thought I'd lose my mind. I finally was able to block it out, but lately, now that Street has escaped and has been all over the news, it's been on my mind again. And I'll tell you something else, Miss Alexander. I don't think Darren Street killed Jalen Jordan at all. I think Tipton did it. And I think Ben Clancy put him up to it so he could frame Street.
Can you prove that?
No, ma'am. I can't. But that's what I think, for what it's worth.
Would you be willing to sign a sworn statement repeating what you've just told me?
At this point, yes, ma'am, I would. It'll probably cost me my job, but I can't live with this kind of guilt anymore. My daddy would be ashamed of me.
Would you be willing to come into court and testify under oath?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any idea where James Tipton is?
No, ma'am.
Clancy and your boss are both going to call you a liar.
Clancy asked me for a paper copy of my investigative files. I kept one for myself.
Grace had to restrain herself from yelling out loud. She wanted to get on the table and break into a dance. She wanted to wrap her arms around Dubose's neck and give him a huge hug. Instead, she picked her beer up off the table and held it up. "To the truth," she said, and she clinked the bottle against Dubose's. "May it set Darren Street free." Chapter 55. I awoke in a barn, tied to a chair, surrounded by three men, all who were wielding shotguns. My head was splitting. They came into focus slowly, like ships emerging from a fog. Mountain men, rugged-looking, beards on two of them, all wearing billed caps, one wearing bib overalls. I thought I recognized him, but wasn't sure. We were in the middle of the barn, with stalls on two sides of us. The place reeked of dung, and I could hear the snorts of some kind of animal nearby. More than one animal, actually. Several animals. The light flickered, and as I looked around, I saw oil lanterns hanging from support posts in three corners.
"He's awake,"
I heard a deep voice say. The man in the overalls stepped in front of me, feet spread. I looked at his boots and gazed up until I met his eyes.
"Give me one reason I shouldn't blow a hole in you right now and bury you back in the woods," he said.
"I'm Darren Street," I said.
"Who?"
"Darren Street. I was James's lawyer a couple of years ago. I've seen you. At the party after his trial. I know who you are, but I'm sorry. I can't remember your name."
"That ain't what the driver's license and paperwork we found in the trunk of your car says. It says your name is William Hickman, and Darren Street didn't have no blonde hair."
"I'm him. I'm Darren Street, I swear it," I said.
"What are you doing coming up here at night with a gun?"
"I escaped from a prison in California 5 days ago. You've probably heard about it. Hell, everybody's heard about it by now. I just got back to Knoxville. The people who helped me get out of prison left me the car, the gun, the clothes, the money, the identification, everything. They left it for me in the trunk of the car so I could..."
"So you could what? Come up here and kill James because he testified against you?"
"No. No, I don't want to kill him. I just want to talk to him. I was hoping Granny might tell me where he is. I went by his house, but I saw it had burned down. So I came up here hoping to talk to Granny." The other two men walked over and squatted in front of me. Both of them stared at me for a long time. One spit a stream of tobacco juice onto my pant leg.
"He's lying," the tobacco spitter said. "It might be him. It might be the lawyer. But I say he came here to kill James and anybody else he could get to."
"I didn't come here to kill anyone," I said. "Listen, the last thing I want is for James to be dead. I need him to clear my name. I need him to tell me why he came to court and lied about me. I need him to..."
"Shut your mouth," the man in bib overalls said. "It's him. Now I can see his eyes good, and I know it's him. Ronnie, walk down to the house and get Granny. Bring her on up here, and we'll figure out what to do with him."
Ronnie snorted like one of the pigs and stalked out of the barn. The other man backed off into the shadows. I racked my brain, trying to remember Bib Overalls' name, and finally it came to me. "You're Eugene," I said. "I remember now, at the party. You called yourself Eugene the Dancing Machine. Had a nice wife named, Sherry, right? And a pretty little dark-haired girl named Dorothy, but you called her Dot."
"You ain't sweet-talking your way out of nothing, counselor,"
Eugene said.
Might as well shut it until Granny gets here. She'll be the one to decide what happens to you.
So Granny's the shot caller on this yard?
What's that?
Never mind. We sat in silence for nearly 10 minutes. It was unnerving, sitting bound to an old wooden chair that was probably used to milk cows, the light flickering, the hogs rooting and snorting, and two men, one who was James's brother, and another I didn't know, lurking ominously. Finally, I heard footsteps and looked toward the door that Ronnie had exited through earlier. Granny walked in first, wearing a pair of black sweatpants and an oversized light blue denim shirt. She had a white cotton scarf wrapped around her head in a Windsor style that covered her hair. She walked into the barn and stood a few feet in front of me. The brown eyes that had looked upon me fondly in the past were now hard and emotionless. There was no compassion. Her face gave away nothing. She reminded me of so many of the judges I'd seen in the past, about to pass sentence.
"I'm sorry to see you here like this, Darren," she said.
"It's good to see you again, Granny Tipton," I said. "I apologize for the circumstances."
"Ronnie tells me you came here to see James."
"Yes, ma'am. I need his help."
"You realize you're the one who is ultimately responsible for everything, don't you? If you hadn't come to James's house and asked him to commit a killing for you, and then bought a gun from him, none of this would have happened."
I shook my head. "I didn't buy a gun from him, Granny Tipton. I admit I asked him to kill Jalen Jordan, and that was wrong. I've thought it about a million times over the past 2 years. I wish I could change it. I wish I could."
"And now you bring more trouble to my home. You escape from prison, and you come here."
"I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know what else to do.
You thought if James would just tell you he killed that boy, then you could run to the judge and tell him who really did it, and James could go on to prison in your place. Is that what you thought? Are you really that naive?
Is that what happened? Did James kill him?"
"James didn't kill anybody," she said. "Eugene, maybe we should just call the sheriff and tell him we have an escaped prisoner on our property."
"No!" I yelled. I began to strain against the ropes. "No! Just kill me, please! Shoot me in the head, but don't send me back! Don't send me back! I'd rather be dead!"
"I don't want your death on my conscience," Granny said. "You've already caused me enough pain."
"What have I done to you?"
"You put my grandson in harm's way."
"I called it off the next morning, and if James has told you the truth, you already know that. I admit I made a mistake by going to him in the first place, but my son's life had been threatened twice. I was terrified, and he was the first person I thought of to ask for help. But I realized I made a mistake, and I went back. I told him not to do it, and I let him keep the money. I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for it every day of my life. But everything he said in court was a lie. I didn't buy a gun from him. I didn't stalk Jalen Jordan and shoot him down on a trail in the woods. I didn't do it. And now I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life in prison? I'll tell you what. You don't want my death on your conscience? You don't want to kill me? Fine. Just lay the gun that was in the trunk of my car down right over there. Cut these ropes and walk out the door. I'll walk over to that pig stall, climb in, and shoot myself. The pigs will clean me up. You won't have to do a damned thing." Just then, I heard the sound of a vehicle, probably a four-wheeler, pulling up outside. A few seconds later, a man wearing a hoodie walked in. He took a few steps inside the door and pulled the hood off his head. It was James. Or at least I thought it was James. He'd gained at least 30 pounds since the last time I'd seen him, and was now nearly bald on top of his head. He stood there looking at me with his hands in the pockets of his hoodie. Finally, after all that time, there he was, in the flesh. There were a million things I wanted to say to him, but only one word came out. "Why?" I said. He didn't answer. He was looking at the floor. "Please," I said. "Was it Clancy?" At the sound of the name, he looked me in the eye, and I knew I was right. "What did he do? Tell me, James. Tell me why I've been in hell for the past 2 years.
He looked unsure of himself. His eyes began to dart around the room from his granny to his brothers and back to me.
I didn't buy a rifle from you, and you know it. And I came and called the whole thing off, I said.
You know I'm telling the truth, James. I've been in prison for almost 2 years for something I didn't do, and I think I deserve an explanation.
If you want to kill me after you tell me why you did this to me, then go ahead. But tell me why you lied.
I let myself get deep into the drugs, he said quietly. I'm off now. But back then, I'd let it get away from me. Granny, Eugene, Ronnie, I ain't ever told y'all any of this. I lied about everything. But Darren's been doing time for something I was forced to do by Clancy.
He took a couple of steps closer to me and drew a deep breath.
When Darren came and asked me to kill that boy, I'd already been freelancing. I don't know why exactly. I guess I just got greedy. I was buying up extra oxycodone out of Florida and paying some boys to haul it up to eastern Kentucky where I'd find a distributor I could count on. Somebody up there got caught and eventually ratted me out to the feds. This agent named DuBose came to see me one night and told me they were about to indict me. Wanted me to give up our operation here, my suppliers in Florida, plus what I was doing in Kentucky. I told him to go straight to hell, but I was scared shitless. He said I was looking at 30 years, and eventually he'd get to all of y'all. I didn't think he'd really get to any of you because he didn't offer any details, and I knew how we'd been doing business all this time, but I wasn't sure. And I was afraid he might be telling the truth about me. I was afraid he might really be able to get to me because of the rats in Kentucky.
James went on to recount the tale of the night I went to see him, and how I hired him and then came back and called it off. He said he betrayed me because he was high and because he was frightened, and then he told a long tale of how Clancy had used him to set me up. As he was speaking, I thought back about the time leading up to the killing, about my conversation with Jordan, about the underwear in the van, about Clancy, the devious son of a bitch. I'd been right all along. It was him.
Jalen Jordan had been stopped by the Knoxville police 4 days before he was shot, I said, when James finally broke for a second. They found a bag in the van he was driving that had two pairs of underwear in it. The underwear belonged to those two little boys who were found dead out of the sinks. The FBI was probably watching every move he made. They would have been talking to Clancy.
He mentioned that Jordan was a child killer, same as you did, James said. But it wasn't until after I did it, after I killed Jordan, that I found out exactly what Clancy was up to. I mean, I knew he hated you, and he'd mentioned he wanted to get back at you, but he hadn't really spelled it out. We met that night and he told me the whole plan. How we were going to pin the whole thing on you. This story about me buying the gun, the deer stand in your garage, the fingerprints on the money, the whole thing. And he did it, too.
He looked at me and shook his head.
You damned sure made it easy enough for him, he said. Running around doing all that crazy shit you did.
Fuck you, James, I said. Like you said a minute ago, I've been doing your time. I've been doing your time in a fucking federal max prison!
I yelled so loudly that Eugene, who was closest to me, flinched and raised his shotgun.
I'm sorry, Darren, James said. I didn't mean for it to turn out the way it did.
Fuck you and your apology! Take it and shove it up your ass! Go and tell my little boy how sorry you are! Go tell my mother, you fucking coward!
I started leaning from side to side in the chair, pulling it forward a bit at a time in an effort to get at him. He started backing away, and I spit at him. The next thing I knew, a boot caught me flush across the mouth, and I went over onto my back. I lay there, stunned for a second, but then I rolled onto my side and was trying to get to my feet when the butt of a shotgun cracked me in the jaw, and I went down again. I lay there on the dirt floor of the barn for a couple of minutes, maybe more. And gradually, from deep inside me, a pitiful moan began to rise. The moan crescendoed into a primordial scream, and I writhed on the floor and screamed until my lungs failed me. Finally, I managed to get back to my knees. I'd loosened the ropes that were holding me enough to be able to semi-straighten my back, and I looked up at James again.
"Do you know what the most important thing a man can gain in prison is?" I said through the blood that was oozing from the cut inside my mouth. "Respect. Without respect, you're either dead or somebody's bitch. I have no respect for you, James, and your family shouldn't either. Because you're nothing but Clancy's bitch. And if you don't do something about him, that's all you're ever going to be."
"I've heard about enough of this boy's bullshit," one of the brothers growled.
And suddenly, all three of them in the barn were pointing their shotguns at me. I heard the hammers cock and waited for the glorious death that was about to come.
"Wait," James said.
"Wait.
Don't kill him."
"Appears to me like it's him or you,"
Eugene said.
"You want to go to prison?"
I looked alternately from the brothers to Granny, wondering what was to come next, hoping they would just go ahead and end it. These were mountain people, bound by blood. If a choice was to be made between one of their own and me, I knew I didn't stand a chance, but I honestly didn't care at that point. Granny, who had stood silently for a long time, finally spoke.
"Cut him loose," she said to Eugene.
The shotguns were lowered. Eugene produced a knife from his pocket, popped open the blade, and a second later I was free. I stood uneasily, my head still aching, my nose and jaw throbbing from the blows I'd received earlier.
"You need to be on your way, Darren,"
Granny said.
"What? On my way? To where?"
"You're on the run. Keep running."
"I'm not running, Granny. We're back to square one. Just leave me a gun and walk outside. It'll be over in just a minute."
"I can't abide sending James off to prison," she said, "even after hearing what he did."
"The only other option is to go to court," I said. "I have a good lawyer. I'll help James find a lawyer of his own. Maybe we can make a deal. If we can prove what Clancy did, James might still be able to walk away from this."
"We don't rely on the law," she said. "We rely on ourselves."
"You relied on it once. You relied on me. You trusted me. I'm not even sure I can ask you this in good conscience after what I've been through. But would you be willing to trust in the law one more time? The system can be skewed by people like Ben Clancy, but for the most part, it works."
"You can't promise anything," Granny said. "You can't guarantee one single thing."
"That's true. I can't guarantee anything, but
like I said a while ago, I was high through a lot of what happened back then. But I did manage to do something that might help," James said.
"Please," I said hopefully, "tell me you have recordings."
"I've got something better in a safety deposit box," he said.
"What is it?"
"A pair of shoes."
Chapter 56. I got Grace on the phone by telling the secretary I was a legendary professor from the University of Tennessee Law School named Payne. Grace and I had both attended UT, and anyone who went through that place had heard of Dale Payne. She picked up immediately.
"Professor Payne? It's Grace Alexander. So nice to hear from you."
"Hello, Miss Alexander," I said. Silence. "Miss Alexander?"
"Just a moment, Professor."
I heard the phone drop onto a desk, heard the sound of heels on hardwood, and heard a door close. More footsteps.
"Darren?"
she said in a high-pitched whisper.
"Oh my God, Darren! What are you... Where are you? Are you all right?"
"I'm fine, Grace. I'm not going to tell you exactly where I am, but I'm close."
"You broke out of a federal prison! In a helicopter! You've embarrassed the United States Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice. Every U.S. Marshal and FBI agent in the country is looking for you. Not to mention every state trooper, city cop, sheriff's deputy, and wannabe cop with carry permit. Do you know the President of the United States mentioned you at a press conference the other day?"
"Really? The President? I'm flattered."
"Flattered? Are you crazy? Have you gone completely insane? They're going to shoot you on sight. Your face has been flashed so many times in Knoxville, it's burned into the memory of every man, woman, and child in the city. They're saying you should be considered armed and dangerous. If you come anywhere near here, you're going to wind up dead, and there won't be a thing I or anyone else can do about it.
I found James Tipton. There was a pause as Grace processed the tidbit.
You found him? Where?
They don't record your phone calls there, do they?
No, Grace said. We're defense lawyers. I mean, we have a way to record if we want to, but as far as some Big Brother thing, no. I would be incredibly surprised.
That's comforting.
Is he alive? She said.
Tipton? Yes. And he has something you need to see. I know it's a lot to ask, but you need to come out and meet me, Grace. What Tipton has could change everything for me.
Where?
Give me your cell number. It occurred to me that I'd known Grace for more than 2 years, had had dozens of conversations with her, felt genuinely close